Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Today, Betsy and I are going to be talking about, you guessed it, romance. We'll be exploring the decline of romance and what you and your partner can do to rekindle the desire. Whether you're single or have been married for decades, we can all stand to make a few improvements to enhance the pleasure of romance, sex, and connection. From the few palpable changes, Betsy and I will suggest. Betsy, you ready?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I was just thinking about Valentine's.
Betsy, it's you and I today. Our guest, our other guest didn't show, but it's always good for you and I to have a conversation.
Yeah.
So I want you first to start telling me about the article that you wrote for the Huffington Post?
Yeah, it's not out yet. But my whole take is that Valentine's Day is really on life support. I mean, we have a whole population of people now who've lost faith in romantic passion. Here is the one holiday of the year that celebrates grand amours, and yet they're extinct. I mean, where are they anymore? I mean, I think cynicism rules, don't you?
I do, because what happens is that some people actually are thinking this. The whole year, you're not really relating to me as a romantic person. Yeah, our relationship is transactional. I work, you work, we share money. And why are we going to celebrate this day as if we have romance our whole year and today we celebrate it? Because there are two things that I see happening. I see that romantic love, sustainable romantic love, mm-hmm. not puppy love, not the first 6 months, you know, is almost obsolete because people don't try to keep it in. They get married and that's it. And the second is that people are getting more sensitive to hypocrisy, which is why you have a lot of people who are just not showing up to religious services, and more people identify as agnostics or atheists because they're just, you know, they just don't believe.
Well, as you say, Valentine's Day puts a magnifying glass on your relationship. And paradoxically, most divorces occur right before and after Valentine's Day, because at Valentine's Day, you're forced to confront your relationship. What is it? Men, in another study, are really afraid of Valentine's Day. I've forgotten the percentage. I think 34% would drop a girlfriend rather than deal with the trauma of giving her the right gift. And women, en masse, are disappointed, left high and dry by Valentine's Day. Afterwards, they feel really let down by their boyfriends. So it's supposed to be a time of celebration, right? But it's a time of crisis and a time of reflection on your relationship. Sometimes that's not pleasant. And then we have men today who are behaving a little bit like those giant pandas. They're not making the mating effort that they used to back in the day when Valentine's was such a hot holiday. So,
I want to pick up on something you said, which is interesting, is that the men would rather drop Valentine's Day than figure out what gift. And the reason for that, part of the reason for that, is that there is a year of nothing really special. Mm-hmm. So the woman's expectation is, you know what, let me see how you're going to make this up. How are you going to make the whole year of non-romance into this day so I can feel better about you? And the guy is thinking, you know what, you know, I work. I go to work. I bring home money. I take care of you. But that's not romance. So you are
under the gun.
A romantic expert. Tell me, number one, is romantic love still possible in this day and age? And how long could it last? And how does a couple either keep it or renew it?
Yes, I think you can reboot romance. I think the problem is that the incentive isn't there, and men have lost the plot. Women have stopped demanding what they want. And we've forgotten really what romantic passion is all about.
Well, tell me what it looks like. What does romantic passion look like?
Romantic passion it's a neural firestorm. I mean, this is something that is so subcerebral, so dramatic. It's such a buzz. And people who are passionately in love feel this 50 years after they've been married. And they're a minority.
Now, if we were looking this on the screen, what would we see?
We would see probably what neuroscientists tell us looks something like a volcanic eruption almost. Love is a soul heist. It's a brain raid. It's an altered state. And that can be engineered by a great seducer or a seductress. It just depends on using imagination, creativity, passionate ardor, and keeping that going. It's entirely possible. It's just that we've gotten lazy, all of us. Women have gotten bitter. Men have gotten crazy, stupid love. I think the guy says, I've gotten stupid and lazy. And that's partly because women now have the sexual initiative, so men don't have to pursue women passionately and ardently. And yet, studies show that women yearn for this. We, in fact, all yearn for...
I think that's part of our universal fantasy.
Yeah.
Is to be in love, to be safe, to be with someone who actually makes time stop, and to be in the presence of someone who makes you tingle from head to toe.
Who's scintillating.
Right. Now there are a couple of questions, because on one level, if everyone was in love, we'd still be in caves. usually cities are built by people who have nothing better to do than to work, because the love thing kind of keeps them home too much. But the other question is, genetically, are we programmed for long-term love, or are we just programmed to fall in love, you know, start having children, and then after that it wears off? Or is it simply a matter of, you know what, you can't make good food starting with bad ingredients. Okay, so many relationships start off, there's nothing there to begin with.
Right, but then you take the passionate ones, the ones where, you know, you see stars and it's a trip to the moon and so forth. There is a phenomenon called the bliss dip. And there's a very ancient art of love, and it's dedicated to preserving love, to fighting that decline into blahsville. That can so often happen. I mean, we get complacent. We take someone for granted. But love doesn't work that way. It's a charged dynamic. It's always in motion, and it has to be constantly fueled. It has to be constantly tended. Otherwise, you are going to become someone's friend instead of someone's passionate interest.
So John, our engineer here, just tapped me. He said, what's the bliss dip and how do I take it?
a bliss dip is called the ramp effect. And that means, obviously, it's the same in drugs, that you take a drug and you need a higher and higher and higher dose each time to get the same bang. So the same thing happens in love, really. But again, as I said, this ancient art of love, which begins in Greece, actually, with a woman named Aspasia, the whole art of love is keeping love, not gaining it. It's pretty simple to get somebody to fall in love with you. But to keep them in love with you, to keep them passionate, to keep them on their toes, that is high art. And that's where these great seducers like Casanova and Cleopatra and people like that come in.
And I still am going to kind of zero in on you, okay?
Because
and John wants to know how, because, you know, the drug thing he gets, okay? he understands the drug part of it. But outside of using the drugs. He wants to know, what are the words? What are those special words? What are the type of tenderness? What should be avoided in conversation? What is the killer of romantic passion? I'll tell you from my perspective in relationships, one is whenever there's any consistent or any show of disrespect. Mm-hmm. Whenever we lose, you know, the sense that this person is the most important person in our life and should be treated as such. Whenever the other person tries to take the role of the mother or the therapist, these are killers of romantic love.
So right. Okay. Yes.
You know, whenever the other person doesn't celebrate their partner's achievements and accomplishments and are comfortable that you could disagree on things. So tell me more, as I started, of some of the killers of romance. Tell me some of the healing of romance. John, stop holding my hand.
Love is maybe the most important thing about love is that we all want an ego boost and not a small one. We want to be special. We want to be the one person in the universe for that other person. And so we can't get enough praise in love. But it has to be targeted, it has to be smart, and it has to be extremely special.
And have a genuine.
Oh, well, of course, that goes with the territory. But I think the biggest killer of love of all, besides contempt, which you mentioned, is boredom. And I think that boredom's the opposite, not hatred. And one of the things we've most neglected, especially in this digital era that we've entered, is conversation. That really is a lost art. But the great seducers, the great seductresses, could literally talk a person into love with them. And what that involves is engaged listening. I don't mean passive at all, and that means body language that shows you really get it, and spirited feedback, plus creating a kind of pas de deux between two people, a collaborative conversation where a man shows a woman to her best advantage. At the same time, this man has got to dazzle a woman with language and wonderful stories and information.
I'm gonna stop you there because here's what you're saying, and I happen to agree with you. Okay, let's break it down. People are in a rut. And if you're in a rut and it's all about work and you come home and you're so burnt out from work that you have nothing to say and you don't communicate and all the communication is just transactional, what did you do today, what was for dinner, you know, so, you know, what do we have to do with the kids? There is no romantic love. Yes, you have to read. You have to take an interest in what the other person is saying. You have to take the interest in something different. Boredom is like a bed sore. If you lay in bed and you don't move, the sore will go right to the bone. If you don't participate, okay, in fun, romantic, new information, new places, new communication, new experimentation, you're going to get romantic bed sores, and they hurt, and you'll end up dying from them.
That's brilliant. Yes, I love that. Well, that gets to the heart of the thing. I mean, Mae West said, love is emotion in motion.
She should know.
And she should know. So as the rappers say, you have to keep it bubbling. You have to keep things percolating all the time. There has to be a kind of sexy flux between conflict and concord, here and there, mystery and intimacy. All of that has to be kept in constant motion so that we stave off boredom, as you say.
What does that look like in the bedroom, darling?
I don't think it I think the variety aspect of sex has been overhyped. If a woman isn't happy with some new variation that her husband proposes, I don't, or her partner, I don't think she should submit to it. I should think, I mean, she can say, I don't feel comfortable with that. I'm not saying she should be rigid and say, I'm not going to play. But at the same time, as I said on one of the broadcasts here, if you're getting double-digit orgasms in a traditional way, why would you, there's a saying in sailing, why would you change your sails?
So I'm going to tell you what I'm going to agree with and I'm going to tell you what I don't agree with.
Okay.
I think that great lovemaking is pure and total regression.
Yes.
It is regressed to the point where there is no judgment. There is just play, and you're playing with your best friend.
Gotcha.
And you're not trying to ring the bell. It's not a sport. The cameras are not on you. You're not focused on the orgasm. You're focused on playing with your best friend and doing the dirty with someone that you could only do the dirty with.
Yes. Well, self-consciousness is the killer, especially for women. You're right.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, and also it's so funny because most guys, when I coach some of the guys, they say, well, you know, we talk about the sex life, they'll say, well, my wife wants to, in the middle of it, you know, she'll bring up, you know, did you pay this bill? Did you pay that bill? You know, where are we going for dinner? In the middle of sex, meaning for everyone who is listening, it's regression, it's play, and the only person in the room that counts is the person you're with. There should be no other conversation, okay? You don't have to create a fantasy. You don't have to try new sexual positions.
Right.
You should try new emotional positions.
That's okay? Very well phrased. And it should be spontaneous, above all.
It should be natural and without judgment.
Yes, yes.
Okay, and it is very important to leave the right amount of time for it, and it is very important to have a little bit of buildup during the week.
Exactly. Scheduling time for it is not a bad idea.
No, correct, because people will say, well, I can't perform under a schedule. Well, at the end of the day, your whole life is a schedule, and when you don't make time for that which is important to you, it doesn't happen. Now, there's a caveat here, and the caveat is that you can't spend your life angry and expect to be a good lover. You can't put down your partner during the week and expect them to just pop up and really enjoy the bedroom.
Absolutely. You carry all of that into the bedroom, and it's the big killer of sexual fulfillment and happiness.
See, I never gave, and I don't. I'm really known for this. I am known for never giving presents on the day you're supposed to. You know, birthdays, anniversaries, you know, never. Because for me, that every day is a celebration of life, you know, and
that was my father-in-law's motto.
And you know what? And when it's done on such a day, it becomes somewhat artificial. Now, I know that people who love doing that, and there's nothing wrong with it. I'm not suggesting that everyone should embrace what I do. But what I am suggesting is that when you forget that you have to think and you have to plan of how you're going to make yourself not a boring person, okay? If life is boring, it's because the person doesn't do the work to make themselves exciting, to dream, to think, to read, you know, to dialogue, to interact, to create new friendships, new hobbies. You know, if you don't do that, if you don't have self-love, and you expect the other person to make you feel good about yourself,
yes,
that's a mistake.
Yes, Maslow called that D-love, when you don't have anything to give. His whole point is you've got to have B-love, that is, you create yourself first. Make yourself as interesting, as fascinating, as multi-sided as possible so that you're forever fascinating to someone, not only to yourself.
Exactly. Now let's talk about some of the I'm going to throw out some of the big complaints that both men and women have, mm-hmm. and I want to hear your opinion. One of the biggest complaints that men have is that they say, you know what, I married a Jaguar and now I have a minivan. You know, and they get upset that the same effort that the woman kept herself in the courting phase, that all of a sudden that effort was gone in the marriage phase and they let themselves get out of shape.
Right.
Okay. What would you say to that?
I would say the art of love is mutual. It applies to both genders.
Oh, 100%.
Yes. Women, too, have to understand that love is not a sure thing. If they find their husband attractive, other women do, too. And they have to stay on their toes. And as one seductress said, she got a man because the other woman wasn't minding her knitting. In other words, you have to take care of this romantic relationship. You can't sink into it, you know, like a hot tub bath. This is an activity, and it has to be pursued with ardor, imagination, and care.
I so agree. I mean, listen, if your restaurant is closed for 3 weeks, don't complain that someone's eating across the street. Okay. Okay. You know, meaning at the end of the day, one is looking at marriage and saying, well, marriage is a commitment. So much of life is a commitment. But marriage in reality, or relationships in reality, is a daily commitment, not a commitment that you make one day that lasts for 30 years. And if you're not aware that romantic and emotional needs exist, sexual, emotional, intellectual specialness exists, you're going to find that maybe the marriage will last, but the romance and the love won't.
That's right. And who wants a practical, lukewarm marriage? And apparently they're on the rise.
Well, they're on the rise for so many reasons. And a lot of that, especially in New York City, is that people don't make any time. Mm-hmm. They work crazy hours. They don't make any time. And they force themselves into a transactional dialogue. And the second most obvious, interesting reason from my own perspective is those people, especially those who are actually incredibly successful in life and business, they don't allow themselves to become more of a Renaissance man or woman and to learn about things that are different and unique, you know, and they don't know how to bring their partner into their own special club with their own special handshake and kiss
Maybe it's not a priority for them. I mean, for many men, it is not a priority to be a seducer or to be a fabulous, sexy husband.
I'm going
to
tell you it is, because what happens is these men who their wives say are boring as hell, they're out in bars really doing a good job trying to seduce other women. The difference is that what happens is that this great, powerful man that everyone respects, he comes home, or she comes home, whatever I say for men, the same for women.
Exactly.
You know, and all of a sudden, they're treated as, you know, they're a moron. And they're not treated with the same respect, and they're not treated with the same sense of empowerment. We like to feel good about ourselves. And we would love the person who we say is the closest person to us to be that person who doesn't purposefully try to deflate the balloon.
True. But at the same time, if a person has a tremendous amount of power at work and comes home and is in that power mode, that's not very romantic.
Not
either.
At all. Not at all.
And I remember reading an anecdote about a famous anchor on television, and his wife just kicked him under the table when he came home and basically said, "Get real, you're home." It was cute. I mean, the way that it was done, in a humorous way, so that they both became suddenly human. They were off air. In other words, the person comes home from work. He's off work now. It's time for fun. It's time for games. It's time for interaction with your wife
I completely agree. Everyone
it's
needs
time
to put
tune
a,
that
right.
out. And all of a sudden think, how can I make, here's a good one, how can I make this person laugh at dinner? Just that one thing. Now, you know, the ancients had a saying, Venus is laughter-loving goddess. And it's considered really one of the most high-volt aphrodisiacs on the planet. If you can make a person laugh, you've got them. Believe me.
Absolutely. Meaning that's one of the things that people say the most is, how could you make someone laugh? So let me ask this question. What would you say to a couple who has none of this? Never did. They got married because, you know, they both felt it was time to get married. Never had the romance, never had the passion, and their relationship is completely boring and transactional, and they're both dissatisfied. Would you tell them to try to reinvent it, or would you say, you know what, you made a mistake, try again?
I think that everything's on an individual basis, don't you think?
Absolutely.
I mean, every marriage is a thumbprint, completely different from every other marriage. So it's hard to make a generalization on that.
So my question is, does there have to be a from your perspective, a basic something to build on?
Yes. Because
I say yes as well.
I think passion is the answer. I think it has to be there in the beginning, and I think it sustains a couple through all kinds of hell. I think once that electricity is there, the chemistry is there, somebody who fries your eggs, that's what you really want in a person, even if you're not really compatible. If that's there, it'll take you through anything.
So you're not talking about a good cook, fries your eggs.
No.
You're saying someone who's cooking.
Okay. No, but I think that's the most important thing, because there's some heavy weather in every marriage, and if that electricity is there, it'll transcend absolutely everything, in my opinion.
Maybe we should teach a class on how to actually do this. You know, yeah, because, you know, at the end of the day, who wouldn't want to feel safe, electrified, stimulated? I don't mean stimulated as in horny. I mean stimulated as in filled with so much desire that the orgasm literally becomes almost meaningless, even though it occurs, because it's just the person.
Well, guess what? We don't teach that. I mean, for centuries, this was taught. The arts of love, the arts of romance. And now what do we get in sex ed classes? We get bananas and we learn how to put condoms on top of them. And we learn, all of the mechanics. But we don't know anything in a sex ed class about how to enamor a person and keep them enamored. Nothing. Zero. All guys get in that department is what they learn on porn and in the locker room. That's it.
So my next question, does porn have any place in healthy intimacy between two people? Or in fact, are we inviting someone in who's really not part of the party of the union?
I think you could reinvent porn. I think it can be very exciting, especially for people who come from repressed backgrounds. I mean, to see all of that can be voyeuristic and sexy and fun. But I think if you look at some of the sexist pornography that's so prevalent now, I think it's very damaging to women and to their self-esteem. Especially in the bedroom, because then they feel the performance pressure that men feel, you know, and it's a no-win situation.
I'm probably more on the not pretty down on porn in this sense. I feel that the essence of what most people fight in their themselves is self-judgment and judgment of others. And the fear of being judged is the singular greatest fear that people come and I treat for the last 37 years. And I believe that pornography, even though it will in the short term stimulate the senses, I think in the long term it's going to create a standard of judgment that is inherently unhealthy.
I think men have stage fright anyway, and this just ramps it up. Men, you can tell me more. But I always had this sense that men are grading themselves in bed, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Meaning the bottom line is when men suffer, and most and literally 30 to 50%, you know, will have a bout of erectile dysfunction before the age of 45,
mm-hmm.
Okay, they go into a panic. Their life is over, okay, because they actually will say things like, I don't feel like a real man. Okay. Not realizing that the sex itself is not satisfying to the woman. It's the continual courtship. Mm-hmm. You know, the sex is the addition to it. And of course it's wonderful. But it's the amount of pressure they put themselves under. And if they're too tired and they can't perform, all of a sudden they get so afraid of not performing, it's like a panic attack. You're always afraid of the next panic attack, even though the first one may have happened because you simply didn't have enough oxygen.
Right. Well, all your defenses are down if you're in the bedroom, if you're a man. And it's terrifying. I mean, to even a coxman, it can be scary.
Absolutely, because you have to be in control. Now, what plays into this? Some men actually have low testosterone. Some men have huge, you know, their numbers are huge, and they don't have this problem.
Mm-hmm.
Some simply are very sensitive to smells, and they have a difficulty in expressing, you know, to their partner of how they can either increase the scent or decrease the scent. And smells very often are responsible for a lot of erectile dysfunction, you know, because, you know, people who actually get along romantically actually like each other's smell, natural scent. And when there's a problem with the natural scent, you have to make adjustments. Either change it or change it in some way, either to remove or add something that creates a desire. Smell is quite important.
One of my theories of the seductresses I studied in this book, and there were maybe 40, 50 of these women, and the reason that they were so successful with men surprised a lot of people, and that is that they were easily orgasmic. They were pleasure claimers. And men really crave that because it affirms more than anything their masculinity. I mean, it's perfectly, it's not
I couldn't agree with you more. When women are multi-orgasmic or they're really enjoying it, it's the biggest turn on for a man.
Exactly.
Okay? It is such a turn off when a woman or a man, but saying, I'm going to give you sex and you lay there, you know, like a corpse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless you're into necrophilia, it doesn't really work.
You know? There are lots of jokes about American women and necrophilia, but I won't go there.
Yeah. You know, I think the only joke I heard is, you know, what's the difference between an American woman and a bowl of Jell-O? You know, the Jell-O at least moves when you eat it.
I love that. Mine was about a Paris hotel, and the man, I thought that he had performed necrophilia, and it was an American woman. Same idea.
Yeah.
But,
you know,
but men and women both need a lot of positive, sexy feedback in the bedroom because we're both anxious. There's so much pressure coming from the media and all over the place about spectacular sexual performances and how you can do this and that to achieve a sky-scaling orgasm. We bring all of that into the bedroom. And whatever we can do to mitigate that, to, as you say, come in with a primal brain and be completely in the moment, the happier we're all going to be.
So I'm going to tell you how that happens and another big problem. And the issue is trust. Mm-hmm. Jealousy will kill any romance. If you don't allow yourself to trust the person, now when I say trust the person, I mean, you know, trust is broken up into integrity and competency.
Mm-hmm.
I trust their heart and I trust their skill. But that doesn't mean then when your spouse makes a mistake, does something wrong, that they should be in the doghouse forever, okay? Because when you tell a man or a woman, I don't trust you anymore, you do more damage than you could imagine. If you say what you did was hurtful to me and it's painful, and is there a way we could eliminate it, that's a great dialogue. Men need to be trusted, okay? Women need to be trusted, but they need to be adored, not just loved.
Yes.
They need to be adored.
They want to be cherished.
They want to be cherished. Men need to be trusted, and they want to be thanked. Okay? They feel that they need their ego stroked, some men more than others. And some women will say, well, you know, everyone strokes your ego. But you know what? Everyone's not sleeping with you.
Women need it more because throughout history they've been the inferior sex. So they, I think, need an ego hike even more.
I completely agree. You know, I absolutely completely agree. And having said that, I think both men and women are responsible to make sure that their own self-esteem is intact and not to expect the other one to create it. The other one should just excite it, validate it, enhance it, but not create it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That comes first. Self-love before love for another.
It's so mechanical, and there's so many things that one size doesn't fit all. Some people like lingerie. Other people simply like a naked body in bed. You have to be on the same page.
Right. You have to have antennae.
Exactly.
I am Betsy Priolo. Dr. Gluck and I both want you to remember, to every problem, there is a solution. Please check out our other episodes on www.gluckradio.com. Buy my books on the art of seduction on Amazon.com. They're entitled Swoon and Seductress. And Swoon, by the way, to your friends across the pond, has just been published in the UK and in Spain. So keep listening and keep sending in your feedback. Till next time.